Hello, and welcome to Player Advantage. My name is Marcus. I am your host through this show about everything and nothing. This week, we're talking about the Avatar live-action movie, not the James Cameron one, being in trouble. We're talking about Final Fantasy VII Remake, because I finally started playing that. We're talking about AEW heels and why Brandi Rhodes is no longer on Twitter. But first, we're talking about Mass Effect 2, because I beat it. So I talked last episode about the fact that I was playing Mass Effect 2 again for the first time in years, and I beat it. First things first, I was very incorrect about the length of that game, because I said last time, I'm about 16 hours in, I'm about halfway there. I was not. I think my final playtime clocked in around 51 hours. And a big part of that was I spent a lot of time, like, if I had just mainlined the game, just done everybody's loyalty missions, grabbed everybody, I would have beaten that game in about 30 hours. I spent extra time doing side quests, doing anything I could to try and drive my Paragon score up so that I could regain Miranda's loyalty, which is kind of the thing I want to talk about the most with that game right now, which is that the loyalty system, for all its merits, is also kind of broken. So what happens in that game, no matter what, this is a thing that always happens. There are two arguments that happen on board the Normandy. The first happens when you finish both Jack and Miranda's loyalties. The other happens when you finish Tally and Legion's. So when you finish, in my case, I did Jack's first, and then I did Miranda's a few hours later. So after I finished Miranda's, as soon as you hit the mission clear screen, you go back to the Normandy, and Jack and Miranda are having an argument about the way Jack was treated by Cerberus and all that. You have to pick a side in that argument. If your Paragon or Renegade scores aren't high enough to just get them to stop fighting, you have to pick a side. So in my case, I picked Jack, because A, she was right, and B, I was romancing her and I didn't want to piss her off. So I said, Miranda, stand down, chill out, okay? And then she's pissed for the rest of the game. Now, if your Paragon or Renegade scores are high enough, you can earn her loyalty back by just telling her, if it's high enough, and by high enough, I mean it has to be almost maxed out, for you to go tell her, hey, be the bigger person. And I never got it high enough for that. On the other side, I got that argument with Tally and Legion, and I just told them, like, I basically went, you're both right. And they let that go. The reason this is important to that game is that the key component of that game, the biggest hook of that game, is that most of your party, if not all of them, can die depending on how you play the game. If you don't get anybody's loyalty, if you piss everybody off, you can lose everybody in your party. And so what happened is I had that argument with Miranda and Jack. I never got Miranda's loyalty back. So then on the suicide mission, the last mission in the game, Miranda dies. She's killed by the collectors, and that's that, because I never regained her loyalty. That, I feel like your score having to be so high in one direction in order to save everyone is kind of like an inherently flawed thing, especially when in the case of like that Jack and Miranda argument, where most people are going to end up siding with Jack. At least the people that I know, at least people in my experience are going to side with Jack, given everything that happened that you see in her mission. And the fact that you've got to, like, I'm thinking about going back and replaying that game again sometime in the future, after I clear out some more of the games in my backlog. And I think that the fact that on that playthrough I'll be able to save everybody because I'm going to carry over my stuff from the first one, I feel like that is kind of an indictment of that system. Like, the game is built to be replayed, and that's the hook, because it was, I would say, 2 years between Mass Effect 2 and Mass Effect 3, and they wanted to keep you engaged in that time. And I think it makes sense that they would do it in this way so that you would keep replaying it. But man, it's frustrating. Where you can basically do everything right from that point up to that point and after that point, and still lose this character because of a choice that you don't have the ability to fix, you know? That being said, the other character I lost was Zaid. And that's a weird one, because I got Zaid's loyalty. I don't know how he died. I guess it's just because he was the wrong choice to pick for the fire team. Like, there's a bit in the last mission where you have to pick someone to distract the collectors, to lead the team distracting collectors. I picked Zaid, and then he died. So I don't exactly know how that works. I don't know the criteria for that or why he died doing that. And that's also kind of frustrating, because I've always been under the assumption that if you gain everybody's loyalty, they'll all survive. And then he didn't. And he was the only one who didn't. And it's very weird. That being said, it's a really good game. It's maybe the one, I think I said this last time, to me, it's maybe the one that holds up the best of all the Mass Effect games. I think 1 has a lot of problems in its gameplay, where it aged badly, and 3 has a lot of problems within its story that a lot of people didn't like. But 2 is the one that, A, holds up really well for me personally, and B, is still regarded really highly by fans. Like, universally. And so if you've got... I think it's on EA Access. So I want to say it's $8. If you've got $8 and an Xbox One, go ahead and fire that up, because that's definitely worth your time if you've got it. So after I finished Mass Effect 2 again, I decided to finally start Final Fantasy VII Remake. Partially because it was on sale. I think it's still on sale to the 19th, so you still got another week to jump in on that Sony summer sale. It was $40, so I figured, why not go ahead and give it a shot. That's a really, really good game, and as somebody who the bulk of the time I spent with FF7 was in Midgar, that's a really, really, they did a really great job of expanding that area of the game. Because Midgar originally was 10 hours. Like, to put it in perspective, my playtime, last I checked, was about 7 hours. And I am just now getting to Reactor 5, if you've played the game before. So, if you remember, Reactor 5 originally is like within the first 2 hours. 2 or 3 hours originally. Because you hit Reactor 1, you go back to the slums, then you go off to hit Reactor 5. Like, it's right away. So depending on how long it takes you to get through Reactor 1, it's really soon. And so they did a really great job, I find, of padding out the time between those two events. Because there's a couple new missions that are exclusive to this version of the game. Like, there's one where you help Jesse out. And speaking of, Jesse, Biggs, and Wedge, three characters who were not people in the first version of this game, in the original. Those three characters are not characters. They are there to be there. They're very much set dressing there to pad out the world, so it's not just Cloud, Barrett, Tifa right away. And now they are people. Like, there's a whole section in there about Jesse and about how Jesse had dreams and aspirations before she joined Avalanche, and what led her to joining Avalanche, essentially what radicalized Jesse. and there's little things like Biggs and Wedge or the Neighborhood Watch. The Avalanche Gang get money by doing collections on changing people's water filters. Like, it's, there's a lot there now. That world feels a lot bigger and more alive, and I really, really like that. Especially considering that, like, the amount of time they took working on this game, where it was announced officially. It was announced officially the day I moved to Vegas. So that would have been 2015. So E3 2015, they announced this as existing. They kind of announced pretty early that this was going to be an episodic thing, that this was not going to be the whole game in one go, because that game is so big. It's so big. Final Fantasy VII, I think, originally clocks in around like 50 hours if you do everything. And so they expanded everything. And I think, personally, I think it's going to be three games, essentially one for each disc. They might be able to do two if they... No, yeah, it's got to be three. It's going to be three games, I think. And look, for this one to be the first one in that series, it's really, really well polished. And honestly, I don't mind if they take their time with the next parts. I think that there's a lot more infrastructure there. They don't have to build as much in. But I think that it'll be late 2021, I think, is my very optimistic prediction for where that next part is. They just really, really expanded on everything, and it's really nice and refreshing to play a remake that adds, you know, that enhances the experience. Resident Evil 2, the remake, and Resident Evil 3, I think that they're really great in terms of the way they play and sort of as a replacement. I wouldn't say that. 2, yes, I would say is a good replacement. 3, not so much. But you get this great thing with this particular remake where this isn't trying to replace your experience with the original. It is, if anything, it's trying to enhance your enjoyment of this series, your feelings about these characters, because they, the other thing that I took from this so far is that they really committed a lot of energy to rehabbing the character of Cloud. Because I think post FF7, specifically with things like his appearance in Kingdom Hearts and Advent Children, Cloud kind of got stripped down to this character that he isn't. Where he got made into this really edgy... Like Cloud the character, as he was presented, was changed to match the perception of him. People perceived Cloud as being this very broody, edgy, dark character, and so he became that. And this is walking that back. Because Cloud, from the little bit I've played, it's very clear to me, at least, that what Cloud is presenting himself as, what people perceive him as, that is a front. Cloud is playing like aloof and mysterious, A, because he thinks it's cool, and B, I think more importantly, because he doesn't want people to know that he cares about them. He's scared of caring about people. He's scared that things will happen to the people he cares about. And it shows a bit on that mission with Jesse when he finds out from Biggs and Wedge, Jesse's, like, her backstory. And he's, like, genuinely trying to help. Like, he's keeping it in his mind of, like, this is what Jesse's fighting for. I want to help her with that. When Wedge gets hurt, he is right there, like, to... He's trying to mask that he's really concerned for Wedge's health. He and Tifa have a conversation, and he lets it slip a little bit. and that's where I'm kind of getting this idea from, because he and Tifa have a conversation in his apartment where he references the promise he made to her. And she's like, you know, that's not what I had in mind. He's like, yeah, but, you know. And he does care about these people. He cares about Avalanche. He cares about Tifa. And Barrett, too, to a degree, is trying to hide that he's hurt that Cloud doesn't want to join Avalanche. And it's really, really fascinating to watch the layers peel back on these characters. But especially Cloud, who ironically lost, I think Square lost who he was. And that showed a bit to me back with Final Fantasy XIII, where I remember thinking to myself, this feels like they're trying to do Cloud again, but they lost what was important about Cloud. Where Lightning is very single-minded, very stoic. This is my goal. I'm going to achieve it. And I feel like that's what people perceived Cloud as for a long time. And I think it's what Square thought people wanted. And I think that now, especially with this, with the care they put into making him a better realized character, to restoring the character of Cloud, I think that going forward, we're going to get a lot more of this guy, because it feels like they found who Cloud was before again. And part of that, to me, I think, is that because Kitase, the original director, worked in a producer role on this, and he worked very closely with Nomura on it, I think that they had this other voice in the room to go, no, maybe more like this, you know? And that's all just me, like, fucking postulating. I don't know. But I feel like that would have to play a factor. They wouldn't have had him as a producer for nothing, you know? And I think it shows a lot of improvement, I think, from FF15, which FF15 was, now that I'm a few years removed from it, because I really liked FF15 at the time, FF15 had a lot of issues in the way that its story was told. And I think Noctis as a character kind of got shortchanged and kind of got put into, to a lot of people, to a lot of fans, was put into that role, that same spot Lightning ended up in, of like, this is what we think Cloud is. I think in a lot of fans' eyes, that's what he became. And I don't know if that's necessarily true for Noctis, but Noctis was kind of done dirty by the game itself, where I think a lot of supplemental materials really informed his character a lot better than the game did, but the game had to come out when it did, you know? This feels like it came out just when it was ready, you know? A big part of that is that we know it took at least 5 years in development, but it feels like they really took their time making sure that the characters were right, that the story was told in a way where it didn't feel rushed, but it didn't feel like they were dragging along, which was kind of my worry. Because a lot of games, especially this generation, have done this thing where they only have so much story, so they're going to add a bunch of little things here and there to artificially extend the length of the game. Like, part of the reason I never beat Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth, I don't know if I've talked about this or not, part of the reason I never beat that game was because it took so much time adding, like, straight up going, oh yeah, we could fix the, you know, we could do the thing with the plot, but instead of letting you start this quest, we want you to go do a bunch of side quests to fill time. Otherwise, it's going to cut down on the length of this game. And I think part of that was that game was originally developed for the Vita. But this game doesn't have that problem, I don't find. At least not yet. Like, when you are doing side quests, I want to say it's like 5 side quests in town, and they're mostly to get money. Like, it is at very least consistent with what the tone of the game is, which is, or what Cloud says, where he's just like, whoa, are you guys going to pay me? Pay me, pay me, pay me. It's, you know, the missions are, go kill some rats. Go kill this Drake. All right, you're done. Here's how you use the assess materia. And they incentivize you doing these quests because there is something to gain from it. And then whenever you're ready, you can go to 7th Heaven. Like, that's the important thing to me about it. And I guess the big difference between adding things so that you don't feel like you burn through the game and adding things to prevent you from burning through the game, if that makes sense. Because this game gives you these quests that are optional, and you only I think you only really have to do like one of them. And then you're done. Anytime that you want, you can go to the bar and trigger the next story sequence whenever you want to do it. And that goes a long way. When you give people the choice, when you give people an option, it goes a long way to making your game feel better to a player. Last thing before we get into the news, I, over the last week, watched and finished Gundam Unicorn, finally. After putting it off for a literal decade, I finally fired that up. It's on Netflix now. And I'll say this off the bat, Unicorn is the perfect culmination of the Universal Century, which is what it's supposed to do. It is constantly referencing itself in universe and talking about the birth of a new era and about the history of the Universal Century timeline. It is, its whole core complex is, it starts at the start of the UC, at UC Zero with Chairman Marcinus. And the Laplace incident, which I don't think was referenced before this. I think that is something new that they put in at this point to be the core conflict of this story. But it is so... it is equal parts celebration and culmination of the UC, where they're constantly talking about the one-year war. They reference the Grips conflict, the first Neo-Zeon war, Char's counterattack. So, Mobile Suit Gundam, Zeta Gundam, Double Zeta, Char's Counterattack. And it's fitting that one of the two protagonists, I guess you could argue three, you could argue that Riddy is protagonist number three, but one of the two protagonists of this series, or of this OVA, these 7 episodes, is Mineva Lauzabi, who is... she is the granddaughter of Degwin Zabi, who started the One-Year War, who took Zeon for himself after the mysterious death of Zeon Zimtycoon. It's very fitting to me that she is one of the heroes of this story. Because of course she is. The story has to end with a Zabi. And it's so appropriate in that way. But Najir, the protagonist, the pilot of the Unicorn, he is, how do I put this? A lot over the last 15 years, 18 years, I guess, since Seed came out, Kira has been called a worse Amuro. If that is the case, then Banagher is the best possible version of Kira. Because they are both driven primarily in battle by the fact they don't want to kill anybody. Banagher, I think I can count on one hand the number of people Banagher kills. I think Banagher kills 4 people.
And it just happens that way. He is so well done. He's in the same vein as other UC pilots, but he is distinctly his own character, which I think is really, really fitting, because the Unicorn is in the same vein as the original Gundam. It's even in the same series. It's in RX, which is not the case for the Zeta or Double Zeta. It's built off the technology that was in the new Gundam. It is all so self-referential to Gundam, where they, at one point, even cut into footage from Char's counterattack of the Axis Shock. And it is swimming in itself. It loves every part of it. And like I was just saying with FF7, this series illustrated to me more than anything else that every Gundam series in the UC is, they are all built to stand on their own, where I think that you could come in at Unicorn not knowing anything about Gundam other than it's about war and giant robots and enjoy Unicorn because it tells you the things you need to know. It references some little things that I, a viewer of this series for years, I catch and go, oh, that's a nice little reference there. Like when they reference Grips 2, there's a ship named the General Rebel. It's just little things like that where, as a viewer, my experience is enhanced by prior knowledge of the series, but it didn't feel like, oh man, I've got to go watch this other thing to know. I feel like the only thing that's like that in that series, and even then it's still a little thing because they do a really good job of explaining it without beating you over the head with it, is they talk about the cloning in Double Zeta. They talk about the Peru experiments, where for a while Marita is a clone of LPO Play. And so that's referenced, but it's not something that you're drowning in exposition with, right? They don't dedicate, a whole episode to a lore dump about it. And even then, I don't even think they reference, like, they don't tell Banagher about it. They talk to Marita herself about it. And that it hits different in that way. Riddy Marcinus, on the other hand, fucking sucks. I cannot properly illustrate the depths of my dislike for Riddy. And it's weird because you're definitely supposed to feel sympathy for him. Because he's got these issues with his father's expectations and with what he feels is the curse of the Mars and his family. But he sucks. he's not good. The impetus for his character is that he has feelings for Maneva. The problem with that is that he has maybe 3 conversations with her before they get to Earth. Like, they talk, he sees her on the ship, he asks her if she wants to go see the Unicorn, and then they kind of get interrupted by Takuya and Mikat, and the other ensign, whose name I'm forgetting right now. And then the next conversation they have alone is after it's revealed that she's Maneva Zabi, because by then she's just calling herself Audrey. So when she reveals that she's Maneva, he flips out. She tells him, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't understand anything. Basically, like, puts him in his place. And then the next time we see them talk, he's like, I'm going to help you escape to Earth because there's something you have to do there. And I'm going to do you this favor, essentially. And then when they get to Earth, he's asking her to marry him, And I feel like there's some conversations missing there. I feel like there's some scenes missing. And I wonder if that's something that is expanded on in Re-96, which is they put out an expanded version of Unicorn that's, instead of being 7-hour-long episodes, I want to say it's 26 half-hour episodes. So there's more space, stuff can breathe a little bit more. And I wonder if that is something that's expanded on. If they interact more in that than they do in the original series. Because right now, Riddy as a character does not make any fucking sense to me. Like, from where I'm sitting, he doesn't make any sense because he asks her to marry him. She doesn't respond. And then on the mission where... there's a mission later. By the way, I'm just going to spoil the shit out of this, unfortunately. If you've never seen Unicorn, skip ahead. There's a mission where... so what happens is Maneva gets captured by the Fist Foundation, and the crew of the Garancière, which is her original ship, and Benazir are teaming up to go get her. And when Riddy realizes what's happening, when he realizes that Benazir is trying to rescue her, he basically tries to take it in a different direction and rescue her himself. And when she turns him down and goes with Benazir, Riddy fucking snaps. And it's so weird. Because it feels very... girls don't like nice guys. I was nothing but... like, he never says anything like this. But it's how it feels. It feels like he's mad at Maneva for picking Benazir over him when... Benazir and Maneva's relationship, there is an element of romance to it, but she doesn't go with Benazir because of any sense of romance towards him. She goes with Benazir because she trusts him. And she goes with Benazir because she knows that whatever she's going to do, whatever she decides, Benazir is going to have her back. And that her place is leading the Ocean. Instead of running away with Riddy and being his wife, which is what Riddy wants to do. And then Riddy snaps and becomes the pilot of the Banshee. I feel like maybe that was the point of Riddy, is he's just the newest in the long line of characters like Hathaway, where he's just dumb. like he sees a pretty girl and now he's just stupid. Riddy sucks, and I wish that someone had just shot him. That's basically it. But yo, if you've been putting off watching Gundam Unicorn, if you've ever seen anything from Gundam Unicorn and you've just had like a passing interest in it, it's a really good series. 7 episodes, each about an hour long. I want to say the finale is an hour and a half. But I burned through that in... let's see. I started watching that last Wednesday. I finished it on Friday. So you can get through it pretty quick. All right, so let's get into the news. First things first. A story that really shouldn't be news, but I think it's worth talking about, because I have a lot of thoughts, and that's what this show really is me going on tangents about things I think about. So, last Friday night, new music dropped. A song from Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion called WAP. WAP is an acronym. It stands for, go listen to the song. And you'll know in the first 14 seconds what that song is about and what WAP stands for. But yo, people got really pissed off about this song. Because I guess we're still doing this thing where we pretend we're surprised
that Megan Thee Stallion and Cardi B are like sexual beings, because we're still doing this thing where we pretend that we're surprised that women are sexual beings. We're surprised that women like sex for some reason. You think humanity would have survived this long if women didn't, if people with vaginas didn't enjoy sex? Because we would not have, frankly. No one is doing, no one is having sex simply for procreation. Let's start there. But, yo, people hate when women express their sexuality. A lot of men, primarily, and specifically conservative women, hate it when women express their sexuality. Because it's certainly not the content of the song that we're offended by here. You know, I've seen people coming out with these, like, little think pieces and, like, videos sitting in the front seat of their car talking about, oh, I got a daughter, bro, and how am I going to explain? Like, if you're that worried about, first of all, if you're that worried about your daughter not having role models, about there not being enough role models for young women, have her start watching basketball. Because I watched a WNBA game yesterday, and if I had a daughter, I would love if she looked up to Asia Wilson. Let's start there. Second of all, people, specifically celebrities, are not here to be your kids' role models. That's not their job. They are not here to parent your child. You are. It is not their problem if you let your kids listen to this song and now they're talking like Cardi B. That's not their problem. That's not their priority. And I think most important here to me about this is just the fact that people have been writing songs of this nature for generations, for decades, for a century even. I was having a conversation about this with my dad yesterday, and we just started naming off songs that we remember where men are talking about sex and it's no problem. Put it into perspective for you. In 2003, 2004, when I was about 9, 10 years old, two songs came out that were on the radio all the time, and it was no problem, despite how explicit they were in nature. Those songs were Get Low by Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, and Salt Shaker by the Yin Yang Twins. Get Low has a line in its chorus that, it, sing along if you remember it, is from the window to the wall to the sweat drops down my balls. All these bitches crawl, all ski ski motherfucker, all ski ski goddamn. Now, I didn't know exactly what skeet meant when I was 9, but I sure as hell knew from the window to the wall to the sweat drops down my balls. And I sang along. Salt Shaker opens with a line that is skeet so much they call her Billy Ocean. Like, please understand, this is not new. My dad told me about a song that, you know, escaped my purview for a long time because it was a little before my time. It's a song released in 1991 by N.W.A. called I'd Rather Fuck You, which is a parody of a Bootsy Collins song called I'd Rather Be With You. Take 2 seconds. Fire up your Google search, look up the lyrics to I'd Rather Fuck You by N.W.A. And understand that this was a thing that these were things that Eazy-E was saying, not on the radio, but on the album. These are things that were said in a song. And there was no problem. The dudes who grew up listening to this are now my dad's age, in their early to mid-40s. And these are the same guys, the same age group, who are clutching their pearls,
about, oh, we can't let the youth listen to this. We can't let the youth know that women like sex.
Like, no, I think if I was, how do I put this without sounding insane? If I was parenting a teenage daughter, I would want her to understand that she has agency over her body and over her sexuality. Because whether you want to admit it or not, we all know that high schoolers, teenagers, are fucking. It's just what happens. We all know this. And it's important, I find, that we let, because they're going to do it no matter what. It's the way this shit works. We've all seen all those movies where it's like, you can't see that boy, but daddy, I love him. We all know how this works. They're going to do what they want to do. And it's important that young girls know that they have agency, that they can derive pleasure from this and it doesn't make them a bad person. And I don't think that's what Cardi and Meg were trying to do, but it is important that women see, especially young women, see that it is okay for them to express their own sexual desires. Because it's weird that boys are allowed to and women have to be stifled. I should back that up. That boys and men are allowed to, and girls and women have to be stifled about the fact that they enjoy sex. It's not weird that women enjoy sex, and we should stop pretending that it's weird. And also, more importantly, we should stop looking to other people, to celebrities, to parent children. I have a sister who is 7 years old. She's going to be 8 in December. Now, I know for a fact that my mother is going to, when she eventually hears that song, or when my brother tells her about it, whichever happens first, she's going to go, can't let the baby listen to this. And she's just not going to let her listen to it. If you're that worried about it poisoning the youth, don't let them listen to it. That being said, I also think my 7-year-old sister should not be listened, should not hear about how Cardi B gets so wet she needs a bucket and a mop. That's just me. But I'm not gonna rake Cardi over the coals for talking about it. Like, the fuck? Also, like, how are you a grown heterosexual male, ostensibly, and you're mad that a woman is talking about how much she likes to fuck? I'm sorry. I thought this was America. I thought this was America. I thought we liked fucking around here. I'm not going to be mad at a woman because she likes to fuck. I'm not going to be mad at anybody because they like to fuck consensually with other adults. You know? So, starting to talk about like our requisite once a month wrestling story. AEW has gotten into a lot of hot water lately. I think the year that company has existed, one of the things that they've been criticized very heavily for is essentially that they don't feature people of color very prominently. They don't feature women very prominently. Both of which are sentiments that have their merits. They don't really feature anybody outside of the Elite and their friends and Orange Cassidy. It's really like the Elite, whoever they decide they want to work with that month, Chris Jericho, and whoever he's going to work with, and Jon Moxley, who sometimes interacts with both of those groups. one thing they wanted to do, and I remember hearing about this a while back, was that they wanted to make it a more inclusive space for female fans. And not for nothing, they have stood up for their female fans, for their transgender fans, a lot over the last year. But people do want more than just the, hey, we're not letting this person in because they're a bad person. They want to see more than one women's match on the show. Dynamite last week had one women's match that was 3 minutes long. Which is bonkers to me. It's a 2-hour show. You got one match, it's 3 minutes long. And this is exacerbated by what happened on... It happened earlier in the day on Wednesday. So when I woke up on Wednesday, the first thing I see when I check Twitter is Brandi Rhodes, the chief brand officer of All Elite Wrestling, the wife of executive vice president Cody Rhodes, she had launched a new... essentially a fan club. I think it was even marketed as such for AEW, called AEW Heels. This is not the first time I've heard this mentioned, I've heard it referenced, but this is the first time I've seen like a statement about what it is. And it was a $50 fan club. It was $50 a year, I think, to be part of this thing, geared towards female fans. And you know, essentially you have a couple... I think one of the things that was available on it was that you get to be part of like a conference call with female wrestlers, and you get social media tips from Brandi, I think was one of the things. Like, it was a list of stuff, but people looked at that $50 price tag and went, hey, what the fuck? Because it's $50 and we're in a pandemic and a lot of people don't have jobs right now, Brandi. What are you doing? And that was kind of the overwhelming criticism Wednesday morning. It's $50. What the hell? People don't have jobs right now. And instead of... I think this is where Brandi and Cody differentiate. Like, the clearest analog to them in WWE is Stephanie McMahon and Triple H. And I think the thing that they differentiate on is that Stephanie and Triple H, I don't think, would have engaged at all after this point. I think they would have sent out, like, a tweet about, like, oh, we understand your criticisms, and we are taking them to heart, and we'll be back with an update on this. If that, I don't even think they would do that, but if they were going to respond at all, I think that's close to what they would have done instead of what happened with Brandi Rhodes and Cody, which was that they doubled down. They doubled down and just kept going. And then that thing happened on Wednesday night on that episode of Dynamite where there was one women's match at 3 minutes long. Big Swole squashed somebody in 3 minutes. That was the whole match. That was the whole, that was all they did. And when people were, the other thing that people were bringing up was like, hey, what's going on with this? And Cody's response was, oh, well, we're doing our women's tournament on Monday. It's like, well, why couldn't you put one of the matches from the tournament on Wednesday on the main show on TV instead of on your YouTube channel? And there was no response for that. Fast forward to the weekend. This is still going, and by Monday morning, Brandi Rhodes had deleted her Twitter account. Now, what I think is interesting is that the reason that Cody gave was that she started getting a lot of racist remarks, which I don't doubt for a second happened. I don't doubt for 1 second happened. That being said, the people that she was responding to were not the people who were saying the racist things. The people that she was responding to and essentially doubling down to
were the people who were reacting to her in, who were asking these questions in good faith, who are fans ostensibly of this product, who want more for the women on the show, who want more content for them, who want more representation, and wanted this service to do well, but also wanted A, for it to not be $50, B, for it to be more inclusive to non-binary and trans people. Because as it stood then, it was just like, for women. And it, the way that it was presented, it was very heavy in its, we are forced for women, and by women we mean cisgender women. You know? And it felt very weird, like, to me as an outsider of all that. Like, to me as a cisgender man, standing on the outside, I remember thinking, this looks a little weird. And then from that, seeing how a lot of people within the community reacted to it, those were the people who were getting the response from Cody and Brandy. And instead of being, oh, we hear you, we understand, it was just defense. Just not, just totally missing the point, to the point where on Thursday, Brandy said, in response to somebody, it's for female wrestling fans. Many female fans don't like women's wrestling. You don't have to be a member. And people again went, what are you doing? What the hell? And they just kept going. And so now Brandi Rhodes deactivated her Twitter account, which she said she got the idea from a conversation with Charles Barkley, of all people. But it's, I feel like this is maybe the third time I've talked about AEW on this podcast. And I don't want to make it seem like I'm some WWE shill who just hates AEW, who thinks, you know, who's ultra critical of them. But I feel like they do this a lot, where they get, and I guess it's just a trait of that group of people, of the elite, quote unquote, of Cody, of Kenny Omega, of Brandy, of the Young Bucks. They're all very online and unable to differentiate criticism in good faith versus people just being mean to them. You know, and I feel like that in and of itself is another problem. And I think that, like, again, I don't want to seem like I'm just dumping on AEW, because there are a lot of things about that promotion that I like. The women that they do have, I think, are some of the most talented people in the world. Like, I think Hikaru Shida definitely deserves to be in the conversation for people who are just ultra talented. Same for Chris Statlander, same for Big Swole. I think that they have a lot of talented people on their roster. I think that they've done a phenomenal job over the last year with Adam Page of making, like me, somebody who did not really care about Hangman going in. Like, I remember at Double or Nothing just feeling largely nothing for the guy. Double or Nothing last year. And now he's probably my favorite singles guy, or he's just my favorite member. He's my favorite member of the Elite for sure. He's my one of my favorite guys in that whole company. I don't know if I'd put him over like Pentagon, but he's up there for me. And I think there's a lot of things they do well, but when people tell them, but let me back this up. I think that there's things that they don't do well, and when people tell them, this is a thing that I, as a fan, would be interested in, instead of listening like they say they will, like they say they do, you know, they said when they started, we're doing this for you, we're trying to make this experience good for the fans, and then when fans tell them, I don't really like this thing, or I would like it more if you did this, they find any way to just tell that fan, we don't care. We don't care what you have to say. This is what we're going to do. And if you don't like it, don't watch. Which is, I thought, was the opposite of the mindset that they had going into it. Like, look, I'm very much in the mindset that if you don't like something, you don't watch it. That's why I don't watch Raw anymore. That's why I don't watch SmackDown. It's why I very rarely watch NXT. It's why I very rarely watch Dynamite. because there's so many things that it's just like, this isn't for me. And I would rather do something else instead of forcing myself to watch a product, watch a television show, essentially, that I don't really like. That being said, the people who run the company should never be saying, if you don't like it, don't watch. And this isn't the first time that one of the EVPs, that the executives of this company, the people at the top of the food chain in this company, not random producers like Road Dogg, constantly gets into these things with fans. And the difference between Road Dogg getting into it with someone and Cody and Brandy getting into it with somebody, or Kenny getting into it with somebody, is that Road Dogg is a producer. Road Dogg is an employee of the company. He is not the executive. This is the same thing to me that if Gar Forman got into it with Bulls fans when he was still there, right? If John Paxson got on Twitter right now and was like, oh, you don't like that we keep picking eighth or that we keep picking seventh? Well, then find a new team to follow. Like, what are you doing? And I have no reason to doubt that Brandy got race-related remarks. I have no reason to doubt that. But the people that she was responding to, the people she and Cody were engaging with, were not the people who were saying race-related things to her. They were people who earnestly, honestly wanted this product to be better, who had very measured, well-thought-out criticisms of the AEW Heels product. And instead of listening to these people who care about this product, who are fans of yours, at least at face value, you're sending a message that you don't care about the people who care about your product. Last thing before we get out of here, it's a very brief story, but it is kind of related to something that we talked about a couple weeks ago, which is that the Avatar The Last Airbender live action product just hit its first major snag, which is that creators Michael Dante DiMartino and Brian Konietzko are leaving the project due to creative differences with Netflix. So I constantly forget that this is a real thing that's actually happening, this live-action Avatar Netflix project. And a big part of it is that it's kind of just existed. Like, it's something that we've known is in the wings, but I'll know it's out when it's out, you know? That being said, it's definitely concerning that they are not involved anymore. DiMartino wrote a letter this morning stating that they're no longer involved with the project, and that whatever comes out is not what they envisioned or intended. And that could mean a lot of things, but it means to me that my interest in this project just plummeted. Because a big thing that plagued that first live action thing, the M. Night Shyamalan Avatar, was executive meddling and the creators not being involved. And so you got just this mess that was totally just out of sync with what the story was presented, with the show as it was presented. And do I think it has to be a direct adaptation of the show to be good? No. But I think that for sure you need those guys there to get the spirit of it right. You need those guys involved in some capacity. They don't have to be running the show, but you need them there somehow, some way, to make sure that you're not missing the point. I think that any adaptation is helped by the involvement of the creator of the source material. Part of the reason I think Scott Pilgrim was so well done was that Brian Lee O'Malley was on set
working it out with the screenwriters, working out with Edgar Wright. And I think that losing those two guys is a big blow to that project. And to a lot of fans, that signals the I don't care about this button. Because the DiMartino and Konietzko are... I'm probably saying his last name wrong. Sorry, Brian. They are two ultra-talented, ultra-creative guys who put together that whole thing. Everything that people like about Avatar The Last Airbender is because those guys' hands were on it. It was them and Giancarlo Volpe. Again, saying your last name wrong. I'm sorry. A lot of people in Avatar went on to do bigger and better things, and that's not a coincidence. I wouldn't say better, but they did go on to shepherd their own projects that went over really well historically. Like Giancarlo Volpe worked on Green Lantern the Animated Series, which is one of the more underrated DC shows. I think that they've got to tread very carefully. Netflix is either going to have to try and bring those guys back into the fold or be very, very careful with how they execute that series going forward. I don't know when that's due out. I think it's supposed to be next year. That sounds right to me, but who knows anymore? It's a weird time, and that's a project that I was already not as interested in as I had hoped I would be, and I'm definitely less interested in now. But hey, that's the show for this week. We will be back next week with whatever comes about. You can follow me on Twitter at Archer Arios, ArxHerArios. Yes, the X represents a C. Please do not make me explain it. Tell your friends about the show if you like it. Until then, take care, stay safe. We will see you guys next time. Thank you.